and he sees them as religion, occultism, spiritual philosophy, and spiritual experience proper. And in the last paragraph, he relates these to four aspects of the person, the physical, the vital, the mental, and the psychic being. Actually, he relates them to both the outer and the inner aspects of these. In their truth, they relate to the inner mental, vital, physical, and psychic being, and its powers and movements, and the universal laws and processes of the occult mind and life which stand behind the material front of the universe. But before that, he's talking about these four parts of the being, and religion being related to the physical, the occultism to the vital, spiritual philosophy to the mental, and spiritual experience to the psychic.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's where we were.
Okay.
We discussed a little bit how a kind of a holistic social sense, all these four find some expression or the other, and one or the other may predominate at certain times and in certain cultures. And that there was a certain intuition of the four working together in the Indian social sphere, even into the what is known as the medieval age, that is the period around or from the 10th to 16th century or so, where we find the what are known as the agamas that predominate and that put themselves out in four forms. One is that of what is called charya, or the codes of conduct which govern so-called Hindu social life. Then there is Kriya, which relates to varieties of ritual, and also finds expression in temple Hinduism. And then there is Jnana, which relates to the whole enterprise of debates and spiritual philosophies. And finally, you have Yoga, which relates to the domain of spiritual experience. So, these four operate together, but predominance of one or the other and going to the background of some of them create problems in society. And it is rarely that we find that these four work well knit in a kind of a holistic or integrated fashion. I think that's where we go.
Yeah, thank you, Devashishtha. We could start by reading that paragraph again, in the very nature of things. Do you think that's good?
Yeah, sure.
I can start. In the very nature of things, all evolution must proceed at first by a slow unfolding. For each new principle that evolves its powers has to make its way out of an involution in inconscience and ignorance. It has a difficult task in pulling itself out of the involution, out of the hold of the obscurity of the original medium, against the pull and strains, the instinctive opposition and obstructions of the inconscience, and the hampering mixture and blind, obstinate retardations of the ignorance. Nature affirms at first a vague urge and tendency, which is a sign of the push of the occult, subliminal, submerged reality towards the surface. There are then small half-suppressed hints of the thing there is to be. Imperfect beginnings, crude elements, rudimentary appearances, small, insignificant, hardly recognizable quanta. Afterwards, there are small or large formations. A more characteristic and recognizable quality begins to show itself. First partially, here and there, or in a low intensity, then more vivid, more formative. Finally, there is the decisive emergence, a reversal of the consciousness, the beginning of the possibility of its radical change. But still, much has to be done in every direction. A long and difficult growth towards perfection lies before the evolutionary endeavor. The thing done has not only to be confirmed, secured against relapse and the downward gravitation, against failure and extinction, but opened out into all the fields of its possibilities, its totality of entire self-achievement, its utmost height, subtlety, riches, wideness. It has to become dominant, all-embracing, comprehensive. This is everywhere the process of nature, and to ignore it is to miss the intention in her works and get lost in the maze of her procedure.
Here in this paragraph, he is beginning to trace this power of the evolution of consciousness from its tentative beginnings, which are in a sense contested and very precarious, rudimentary, as he says, and insignificant, but establishing themselves in more and more sort of secure grounds till there is the possibility of the emergence of the person. And with that, there enters the possibility of a reversal of consciousness. So this is a kind of a transition, a paragraph of transition, in which he's reiterating this kind of movement leading to the human being. But he points out that this particular kind of motion of the evolutionary force has to constantly work against the action, against the action to dissolve the movement, the gravitation, as he says, the downward gravitation, failure and extinction. And at the same time, not only is this a vertical movement of trying to affirm greater consciousness, but also a horizontal one, which opens into every field of its possibilities. So this double movement opening out towards the sort of affirmation of consciousness and also trying to include all its various manifestations is the way in which this force moves in nature, is what is the drift of this paragraph. And he ends it by saying that these are the movements that he's drawing attention to, that we should not ignore this particular drift, you may say.
So I guess the point is not to miss something because it's happening in small quanta, because the goal is also comprehensiveness more than just velocity, right?
Yeah, that is partly it. And also that in its beginnings, that it may be crude, as he says. You know, there may be crude beginnings, but if we throw out these phenomena because of their crudities, then in a way we may prevent the emergence of consciousness from occurring. So in both these ways, a certain kind of a prescience is required at every stage to make sure that our sort of handling or even understanding our knowledge of bringing to knowledge of these movements doesn't sort of trample on their possibilities.
Yeah, thank you, Devashishtha. Bindu, would you like to read the next one?
Sorry. Yeah, I will. It is this process that has taken place in the evolution of religion in the human mind and consciousness. The work done by it for humanity cannot be understood or properly appreciated if we ignore the conditions of the process and the necessity. It is evident that the first beginnings of religion must be crude and imperfect, its development hampered by mixtures, errors, concessions to the human mind and vital part which may often be of a very unspiritual character. Ignorant and injurious and even disastrous elements may creep in and lead to error and evil. The dogmatism of the human mind, its self-assertive narrowness, its intolerant and challenging egoism, its attachment to its limited truths and still greater attachments to its errors, or the violence, fanaticism, militant and oppressive self-affirmation of the vital, its treacherous action of the mind in order to get a sanction for its own desires and propensities may very easily invade the religious field and balk religion of its higher spiritual aim and character. Under the name of religion, much ignorance may hide, many errors, and an extensive wrong building may be permitted. Many crimes even, and offenses against the spirit may be committed. But this checkered history belongs to all human effort, and if we were to count against the truth and necessity of religion, would count also against the truth and necessity of every other line of human endeavor, against all man's actions, his ideal, his thought, his art, his science.
So here is again Sri Aurobindo's move. Explorations of human consciousness or social consciousness always moves from the near to the far. And as with everything else, over here he sees religion as being a certain kind of a conduit, a vessel for some expression of spirituality. But this vessel may be, in many cases, extremely, in some ways completely deny the possibility that it contains. So one may be apt to reject it, but this is where he points out that nevertheless, this has been the case of human evolution in all matters, in all the various domains of expression. And in a way, he even made this particular sort of argument for the rise of terrorism during the period that he was active in it, in Bengal, that it has to purify itself over time. But that does not mean that we have to deny it any expression from the very beginning. There has to be an evolution that takes place, but we have to start somewhere. And our beginnings are often crude because we don't have the proper, clarity. But without beginning, we have no chance of emerging, you see. So religion is a beginning towards the spiritual, life. And that beginning has to be given its due in spite of all the errors and crudities that it contains and that can hide or deny the power of spirit.
Devashish, maybe you've answered this before. Could you elaborate on why he sees religion as being associated with the physical part of a being?
Yeah, in a sense, because you see, it is the part which is more codified. It is all the various more mechanical aspects, the kind of forms that can be given by which spirit can be made accessible in a so-called predictable way to human beings. So, and a lot of these have to do with the physical, in a sense, the disciplines of the body. The ways of disciplining attitude of various kinds of physical and mechanical actions undertaken either through the use of mantra, through the use of mudras, through the use of, I'm talking in an Indian sense, but there are parallels to this in most religions, where exercises of the body and of various formal nature constitutes what we call religion. Plus, there are customs that enter into social behavior also, which tend to be more of a mechanical nature. But in that mechanical nature, there are habits that are related to certain ideas of spirit. See, so that I feel is why he gives it this formulation of the physical.
Yeah, actually, I remember, I think it's somewhere in the synthesis where he makes a case for and defends the use of rituals, saying something to the effect that our physical body, which is the infrarational part of our body, needs that as a kind of a prayer. So he does give religious rituals even its place in the approach to the God or divine.
I don't know whether it's in synthesis. I'm not sure. It's slipping my mind, but I have a feeling he talks about this in the Foundations of Indian Culture,
okay,
where he's talking about Indian religion. But one must also realize that, I mean, in this entire subject is a very loaded one, because again, this is the very one of those subjects where one has to put all the various sayings, let's say, by Sri Aurobindo and the mother together and look at them in a sort of a historical way. Because my sense is that there, of course, there may also be differences in emphasis between how Sri Aurobindo and the mother view this subject of religion. But at least if we look at the pronouncements of Sri Aurobindo, my sense is that he is treating it in an evolutionary fashion, that, you know, it has had its day. You see, it has had its necessity, its need to refine, to make the spirit accessible to a more primitive mentality. And it has reached a point where it has to cede to more true and inner forms of expression. Now, physical expressions of some kind may be included within that, And it may be that religion is the first vehicle for spiritual expressions of the physical. But perhaps in its evolution, it yields to what he calls spiritual experience as, you know, the various physical aspects of that.
Right, I hear you totally. Yeah, raises more interesting questions. Yeah, I guess one could see in terms of the practice, it is determining, sorry, I'm at the loss for words, but it's determining what you privilege. I'll just speak from my own experience. Often when I'm at samadhi, it's not that I'm kneeling down as a formality, but because of the overpowering energy I'm feeling, almost makes that the appropriate gesture for my body. So it's the spirit driving the physical in some ways. So yeah, just a thought, a tangential thought on that. I'll leave it.
No, sure. I mean, so there may be physical aspects to spiritual experience. Definitely there may be certain innate tendencies of the body, as well as the fact that some of these are social mediations. There's nothing wrong with social mediations too. Social mediations are a part of cultural history. It may be that certain cultures create certain social forms to make the spirit physically accessible. And these become the, you know, the normal attitudes taken by the body in those cultures. It may also have further, I mean, relationship to a secret or occult anatomy. But the thing to realize is that, to bind it to a form is what religion usually does. Religion tends to take these kinds of forms and create, codes with them, social codes with them. And these codes are, again, at the physical level. So, I mean, I'm talking about the physical social existence. So that's where, in a sense, there has to be an evolution where cultural history has to also become subjective and can become choice in an individual, rather than retain a certain orthodoxy to it.
Yeah, sure. The other interesting thing that I picked up from just your words a few moments ago is that if we look at religion from this evolutionary perspective and make the argument that it's not really no longer necessary as an approach to the spirit, we're actually making a claim for the social evolution of humankind, which is, yeah, again, a very subjective. I just wanted to note that, I guess.
I agree. There's also a subjectivism there. And, for whom are we talking? That becomes the main question there. Certainly at any time, various segments of humanity are represented. And again, evolution or even social evolution cannot be affirmed for all human beings at any time. It is, again, a certain kind of a mix. And it's interesting in this very chapter, the way Sri Aurobindo deals with these four aspects. And, at this point, he begins introducing these concepts of the four types, but further down he'll give a historical, slant to the whole thing. And there too he'll point out that even if we look at these as various stages, at any stage all of them coexist. And then nature, as it were, or the evolutionary force, if you want to call it that, make sure that nothing really disappears. The proportion may change, but to some extent, there is a retention of you know, of all the forms to some degree.
Right, yeah. Thank you so much. That was very illuminating. Yeah.
Lopa, you can read the next one. Oh, you have a question?
Yeah, Devashilda.
Yeah.
About Hinduism, it is said that it is not a religion, but it's a way of life. By that is meant that in origin it was not a religion, but religion was brought into it for helping some people who need it.
Yeah, it's a difficult question to answer, Lopa, because you see, I mean, notion of religion, actually, if you look at the history of Indian, I mean, let's call it the social forms of spirituality or the formal codifications of spirituality. If you look at it, like, look at the history of that in India, and actually he discusses it a little bit later, but if you look at the history of that in India, we find that to start with, you had a tremendous number of different sects. You know, it's even not very sort of certain that what we today call the Vedas and Upanishads had any dominance in India until a quite late stage. They coexisted with a variety of other approaches. Now, one idea of so-called Hinduism, one of the big difficulties is that the word Hinduism, nothing like that existed. It's a foreign term. But if you try to look at...
There was
someone lost him.
We can't hear you. Oh,
yeah,
his call dropped. Okay, I'll get him back in. He's showing as busy, so we'll just give him a minute, I guess.
Hinduism as a religion, and I was pointing out that, of course, the term itself is problematic.
Good job.
It's a modern term, but I would identify two or three stages to what we call Hinduism. At first, as I was saying, there is a cluster of where you see what happens is within a social milieu, you may have a kind of a what is called a discourse, that is a variety of practices that develop in by themselves with a certain amount of independence, but then there is also a conversation among them. So there is a certain kind of commonality. But at the same time, there is an independence of these various, you know, sort of practices and ideas. So this was more or less what it was like to start with. But, you know, around the 4th century or so, we start getting an integration of some of these. What we know as temple Hinduism or Puranic Hinduism comes into existence, and this from the very get-go, so to say, has some commonalities. As we know that they also develop independently with Shaivite, Vaishnavite and Tantric sects, Shakta sects, but in the social milieu, it's particularly from the Gupta period, that they are given a certain homogeneous look. They are kind of given a single platform, to so to say, a single context within which all these various gods can be worshipped, and there can be a kind of a give and take among them. Idea of a kind of a umbrella religion begins to emerge. around the 10th century or so, this gets even more of a certain kind of an ideological framework with, the Vedantic philosophers, Shankara and those who follow him. They give a certain kind of a coherence, they knit a coherence by creating a certain, structure. Putting these Vedantic sort of interpretations or glosses as the meaning of all these various Puranic sects. So that starts giving it an even greater coherence. But still, I'd say that there isn't really the sense of a quote-unquote religion which is homogeneous. Idea of a homogeneous Hindu religion is really quite a modern phenomenon, and I see it as part of the whole nationalistic construct with the arising of a nation. National identity tends to simplify practices and give them a single look, you may say, a single kind of a codified structure. This has been slow in coming because Hinduism itself has a tremendous amount of leeway for these kind of sects to develop by themselves. But at the same time, there has been a kind of a consistent approach towards creating a sense of a single structure, single religion, so to say. So, to answer your question, Lopa, it's a very complex question. I'd say that the notion of Hinduism as not a religion or as a cluster of spiritual, somebody has called it a culture of spiritual seeking, is one way of looking at it, one extreme of looking at it. And to look at it as a kind of a construct of, almost like a national sort of religion is the other way of looking at it. Both these coexist in the social imaginary of India.
Okay, thank you. So by national religion, are you saying that this was something that was fabricated by the British Raj when they united the nation?
No, not by the British Raj. But you see, idea of nationalism is that of a single people who have to be, so to say, given some sense of identity. Now, that immediately creates a certain contested reality. A people may be a single people without labeling themselves as such. India, you may say, was a nation long before it knew it was a nation. So what happens with modern political nations is that on the outside, it needs a certain political framework to give that stability by which that objective political framework can maintain itself in the minds of the people. This leads to what are called contested histories. All the various ideas of the nation are such ideas that are to some extent that rest upon various subjective ideas of what it means to be Indian. Among them, one of these ideas is to be Indian is to be a Hindu. You see, that is the whole notion or construct of Indian nation as what is known as Hindutva. The whole notion of Hindutva is a kind of a national construct. It's a simplification of the religion to fit an identity sense of identity. You see, that becomes a certain kind of a religion.
So at which point of time this thing happened, the Hindutva concept came, that to be Indian would mean to be Hindu?
It comes during the nationalist period itself, Again, this is a very complex question because you see, to some extent, people are debating over when it first arose and who makes it arise. We may say that there is an amorphous sense of this culture of seeking, which is mobilized by the nationalist movement. People like Sri Ramakrishna, Vivekananda, etc., all mobilized this idea of identity, of India being the place where spirituality was kept alive. Sri Aurobindo gives it a very nice definition. He says, India preserves that which preserves the world. He has it, of course, in a poem of his. But these kind of ideas of Indian identity in locating a certain uniqueness for it become, in a sense, get taken by certain sectors of the nationalist movement and made into more fossilized kind of identity structures. I would say, for example, the RSS and the whole so-called Hindutva movement do that, the Hindu right, as it is called, do that. They take the more amorphous sense of a culture of seeking and turn it into a distinct kind of codified identity structure. That these are the characteristics of what we call Hinduism, you see. Mm-hmm.
Devashish, on a tangential note again, actually Peter Rees has got this excellent article where he actually wrote the article because the BJP party was co-opting Sri Aurobindo as one of their leaders. And he clearly distinguished how the nationalism of Vivekananda and Sri Aurobindo was based on spiritual experience and was very different from the feudal movements, which was the base of the RSS and BJP. I forgot what it's called, but and he really wrote it also during the political rise of BJP and RSS about 6 years ago.
I read that article, in fact, quite some time back. But yeah, apart from that, I mean, this particular sort of subject has been studied quite extensively because it has resulted in two different approaches to the whole idea, a large spectrum of approaches, you may say, to the understanding both of what is Hinduism as well as what is it to be Indian. You see, this it has become a very complex ground that needs careful treading, so to say. But to some extent, it's important to also note, as a, that's the partly the reason why I was trying to trace its history, that nationalist period is not the start of this idea of unified Hinduism. There is a longer history to it, but nevertheless, something happens which flattens it a good deal, to a large extent, due to this need for an identity that can be labeled. You see, nation states. I think Rich was trying to call me. Hello?
Yes,
can you hear me?
Debashita, we had got Riches in the call, but it says call held remotely.
Oh.
Maybe he called you? Is he calling you?
Yeah, he called me. Let me see what
I'll just write him and say that you are in this conference.
Yeah.
I wish you start to continue your line of thought. There are actually two movements. One is the codification of the spiritual fount of Vedas and Upanishads codifying itself in Puranas is a religion, and one is the nationalist movement which attaches itself to it. Would that be right?
Yeah, the history of it is really, actually, you may say, look at it like this, that codification to some extent was very early. Vedas existed, Upanishads existed. When the Upanishads came up, they coexisted with a variety of other philosophies as well, many of whom we don't even know today. You know, we know that during Ashoka's time, there were a bunch of, you know, sects that you can't even call Hindu in any particular sense. You can't even call them Buddhist or Jain, for that matter. For example, the Ajivikas. There's a number of sects of this kind that you can call spiritual, but you can't label them in terms of, you know, any particular affiliation with any text. They were based on gurus. Who each, and Buddha himself, you see the history of biography of the Buddha, he goes to a number of teachers, and the teachers are named, their practices are named. They are not Hindu teachers, nor they don't even affirm the Veda or Upanishad per se, but they have spiritual realization. So this is the large idea of a culture of spirituality that formed the social habitus of India during, say, even Buddha's time. But I think one of the first, you know, you may say, one of the early people that threw a stone in this amorphous sort of setup was the Buddha himself. Buddhism was one of the earliest so-called quote-unquote religions of India, because it set out to separate itself from what are called the Astika sects, and it became very successful because it got political patronage. No other sect before that had got political patronage. Ashoka gives Buddhism political patronage and makes it part of an empire. You may say this is a pre-modern version of what we call Hindutva and the modern nation state today. So, you know, that creates a new kind of appearance of religion in India. And by the Gupta period, we have the Hindu version of what happened during Ashoka's time. That is, we start having amalgamated practices under a single roof, under a single context. So that is the beginning of what we can call Hinduism. But at the same time, it's extremely syncretic. All these practices, all these sects, they are coexisting, they're doing their own thing, they're borrowing from each other, but at the same, and they're acknowledging each other in a kind of a sort of a, you know, independent way. But at the same time, there is a sense of an umbrella under which they all exist. So that is the beginning of it. But you find over time that also develops more and more, sort of distinct structures. With Shankara, we get very distinct structures. It's the beginning of the Mathas, the 10 orders of sannyasis, and, you know, the four Mathas and all that. So there is a quasi systematization of what we might call Hinduism, what we are today calling Hinduism. You see, so these are things that precede the more distinct fossilization that takes place during the nationalist period, and more so after the national, in post-colonial times. It becomes, you see, allied to the nation state because the nation state as an objective entity needs to classify people. It needs to have very distinct ways by which it can characterize people as belonging to a certain religion or belonging to a certain set of practices. People give themselves names or identities not based on who they are, but based on what they do. So this makes it even more, codified and rigid. And that's part of the entire, and you know, then that feeds back into the subjectivity of the people who call themselves Hindu. You see, Hindus fall into that subjectivity that is created as a result of this necessity of national identity.
Debashita, when you said that during the Gupta period, it was a political patronage of Hinduism, are you also saying that currently also there is a political patronage of Hinduism?
No, I don't think there's political patronage of Hinduism today, but today we have contested ideologies. We have people who have created a history of India as a Hindu nation, for example. That is an ideology. So that is the patronage of that ideology is a more impersonal thing than the patronage of an emperor. See, but it's nevertheless as powerful.
But who believes it? It's the people who have created this myth are the ones who believe it. It's not that the world at large believes it, right?
Yeah. No, the people who have created this ideology, they believe it, and as I said, it feeds back onto those who call themselves Hindus. So, you know, what does it mean to be a Hindu? So you are given an ideology, so there is a change in the version of your own identity as a result of this. These are very subtle things. For example, before the Indian nation came into existence, Indians did not go around thinking of themselves as Indians, right? It's a post-colonial construct that we all call ourselves Indians, and it becomes a subjective thing as well. We have pride in being Indian, belonging to India as a nation, so to say. Similarly, it becomes a subjective thing. It's internalized and it associates itself with our emotions and feelings.
So you're saying that similarly there is an identity called Hinduism that people have adapted themselves to.
Correct. Ideologies create realities which then become subjective for those who accept it. And sometimes the tricky part of this whole thing is that they don't occur in a vacuum. They occur in a history, a cultural history, where these same things had other understandings and other appearances before, which were more amorphous in nature. And the people who receive this labeling through a widespread ideology or a propaganda end up believing that they are what the new version is telling them. Over time, it changes into something else.
And while it is changing into that something else, the new version has become more exclusive.
Yeah, exactly.
So when the Mughals came in the whatever century they came into India, was there that concept of us and them? Or this is newer than that?
No, it not that it wasn't there. It was there because, you see, Mughals didn't come into India, I mean, also in a vacuum. Mughals came quite late to India. The sultans first came to India. And the history of the sultans in India was a history of Islam. Mughals were slightly different.
We can hear feedback. We're getting feedback from Rich's machine. Rich, can you mute your machine?
So did you ask me to read?
No, I was asking you to mute it because we're getting feedback. Debashista was talking about the
Mughals
Indian religion. Yeah, Mughals and Sultans.
I was saying that the sultans, when the sultans came, there was a mixture over there of, you know, both the will to Islamicize India. So a sense of difference of us and them was present there. With residents in India, even from the Sultan period itself, other versions start emerging. You see, there are other more syncretic versions that begin emerging. Whole notion of an Indian history which includes, or an Indian spiritual history which includes the practices of Islam and of you know, put at the mystic level, at the spiritual level, kind of sharing and you know, mutuality start expressing themselves very early. You see, Mughals are in fact, with the Mughals, what happens is, just as we were talking about state patronage, by and large, with the Mughals, there is state patronage of this kind of a unified spirituality or a hybrid spirituality, you may say.
The sultans, are they from Persia?
No, they are what are called Turco-Afghan. They're Turks from Afghanistan. They're Turks, meaning they're nomadic people of Central Asia, settled in Afghanistan, who come into India. You know, and then after that, there is a succession of these people who come through the Khyber Pass. And Babur comes only in the 16th century.
Okay, and Babur is from the now what we call the central CIS countries, right? Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, and those places.
Yeah. He's basically from what we today call Uzbekistan, etc. Uh-huh. Right. His background is in Samarkand and Fargana.
Okay, so the culture the sultans brought is what we know as Sufism.
No, not really. The sultans did not bring Sufism. Actually, entry of Islam into India predates the sultans. And in fact, from the 7th century or 8th century, Sufis were entering into India in places like Multan, and Punjab, and even in Gujarat to a large extent, and even in Bengal, you know, Sufis had already entered by the time the sultans came. Sufis, you know, were both converting, as well as many of them were not converting, were just preaching their message as a part of the of the spiritual culture of the land.
Sufism also, the Sufis came because they were being persecuted in Persia and Iran, right? And always
To some extent, Bindu, but some of them just traveled to India, you see.
Okay.
Persecuted in Iran, you know, that actually, see, you know, I mean, 13th century and all that, the Sufis were not really being persecuted. Turkey, in fact, I mean, this is long before the Ottomans. This is the Seljuks, you know, were patronizing Sufis in a major way.
Yeah, I always liked that bit about Indian history that, I mean, Islam has got such bad rap even in India these days that it's so nice to know that the Sufism was the first entry of Islam into the country.
Yeah, it was. But, you know, Sufism also had its varieties. And even during the Mughal period, you know, what we attribute the whole history of Islam in India and the whole two-nation theory would have been very different. Had it not been for the action of the Naqshbandis, which is a Sufi sect in India, they were, those Sufi, they were orthodox, and they, you know, were egging the ulemas to create that sense of us and them. And that is largely, there was a power struggle between the Naqshbandis and the Chishtis in the Mughal court. And it's the Naqshbandis who win out with Aurangzeb. That's partly the reason why the whole sort of, you know, structure that was laid by the Mughals gets demolished by him.
Mm.
And sir, go ahead. Sorry.
No, I was just saying, so, you know, I mean, when you really look at the history of both Hinduism, Islam, Buddhism, if you look at the history of religion in India, you see what Sri Aurobindo is saying. It's very complex and it trends to it. But there is the tendency towards fossilization of any one of these. So that whenever that fossilization takes place, it creates a certain kind of a version which is more and more rigid and, you know, suppresses other types of histories, which is what has happened today. Today, the whole idea of both in the Hindu and Muslim mind, this big divide which has occurred is partly due to revisionary histories that have been telling people that, you know, it has been from the very beginning just these two completely different people who have warred against each other and trying to gain supremacy over the land, over the minds of people.
And that's not always true. Like when the sultans came, was there a real conflict like there was during the Mughal period?
No, that's what I'm saying. I mean, like Mughal period, meaning there was a conflict only during Aurangzeb's time. In the Mughal period, largely there was no conflict in the Mughal period. And, you know, I mean, in fact, in the Mughal period, there was the closest that we've ever come to the you know, the hybrid one nation of Hindus and Muslims. During the Sultan period, there was, you know, kind of, it was more choppy, you may say. The things were more choppy, but they were not clearly defined.
And Aurangzeb's trend towards separatism was because of the Naqshbandi sect of Sufism.
Yeah, that played a very strong part. The ulemas and the Naqshbandis, they played a very strong part. You know, they played into, he played into their hands partly because of the religious politics of the court of Shah Jahan, his father, because the eldest son who was to become the king or to succeed in Dara Shikoh was an out-and-out Sufi and of the Chisti kind, and who actually saw, he wrote a book called The Meeting of the Two Great Oceans, which is about the Upanishads and Islam. So, hello, are you there?
Yes, Dvashita, we are there.
Yeah. So you see, as a result, you know, the other factions, you know, fed upon Aurangzeb to turn him into, you know, into a hater of this kind of attitude. So it partly had to do with the court politics as well.
So it is not true that all sects of Sufism is or are in essence holistic and all-embracing.
Yeah, you see, the thing is, in essence is another matter. In essence, they may be holistic and all-embracing. But in practice, you know, this is where ground realities and you know, text realities are two totally different things. And that's the whole thing about history and about, you know, generalizations. We find that the ground realities often betray a completely different appearance from what you might expect them to have based on the texts.
And they have also evolved in their own ways.
Yeah, they were involved in their own ways here.
Should we read the next paragraph?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Which one is it? In the very nature of things? Oh, religion has opened itself to denial. Religion has opened itself to denial by its claim to determine the truth of divine authority, by inspiration, by a sacrosanct and infallible sovereignty given to it from on high. It has sought to impose itself on human thought, feeling, conduct, without discussion or question. This is an excessive and premature claim, although imposed in a way on the religious idea by the imperative and absolute character of the inspirations and illuminations which are its warrant and justification, and by the necessity of faith as an occult light and power from the soul amidst the mind's ignorance, doubts, weakness, incertitudes. Faith is indispensable to man, for without it he could not proceed forward in his journey through the unknown. But it ought not to be imposed. It should come as a free perception or an imperative direction from the inner spirit. A claim to unquestioned acceptance could only be warranted if the spiritual effort had already achieved man's progression to the highest truth consciousness, total and integral, free from all ignorant mental and vital mixture. This is the ultimate object before us. But it has not yet been accomplished, and the premature claim has obscured the true work of the religious instinct in man, which is to lead him towards the divine reality, to formulate all that he has yet achieved in that direction, and to give to each human being a mold of spiritual discipline, a way of seeking, touching, nearing the divine truth, a way which is proper to the potentialities of his nature.
So, I think Rich's guitar is playing in the background. So, yeah, it's interesting. One thing to note about this paragraph, I mean, as he points out, that within all this crudity, religion has a certain element of absolutism to it. It makes a claim in the name of the invisible and the infinite. It claims an absolute source of authority. This is the problem with all religions, you know, particularly those that are founded by prophets and messiahs, and even others that are propagated in the name of something infallible. You know, the word of God, as one might say. This word of God falls into a relative medium, the medium of ignorance. And in that medium, there is no way of verifying or judging to what extent this is true or false. This renders it relative. And this is the point that he's making over here, that the mind demands from it a certain kind of relativism, that it be consulted, and that it be, so to say, that it be conducted with discussion and question, you see. But, you know, there is a term that is used lately, it's called aporia, A-P-O-R-I-A, and aporia is where two knowledge systems collide and neither understands the other. It's a dead end, you see. So if reason demands a certain kind of relativism, a certain kind of, power of being able to negotiate through discussion the meaning of truth in religion, religion refuses that demand because it says that it is receiving truth from on high. So this becomes the problem of aporia in the acceptance of religion. Now, either it has to take a stand on what is called blind faith, or it has to take a stand on the purification of the nature, and to a point where whatever is calling itself truth from on high can be recognized as such. This demands an evolution of nature. That's why he says, a claim to unquestioned acceptance could only be warranted if the spiritual effort had already achieved man's progression to the highest truth consciousness, total and integral, free from all ignorant mental and vital mixture. This is the ultimate object before us, but it has not yet been accomplished, and the premature claim has obscured the true work of the religious instinct in man, which is to lead him towards the divine reality, to formulate all that he has yet achieved in that direction, and to give to each human being a mold of spiritual discipline, a way of seeking, touching, nearing the divine truth, etc. So, it doesn't achieve its goal before it gets questioned. And on the other hand, it, you know, denies the power of questioning on the basis of its own spiritual authority. This brings about an aporia. So religion has its place to prepare the human nature, but the human nature has to outstrip it in its self-purification to reach purer forms of approach to the spirit.
So essentially, he is telling that religion was the helper and now religion is the bar.
I'm not being very explicit like that. This is a complex paragraph, as you see. He's not being explicit in that way, but in a sense, yeah, he is saying that it is a helper, but it is, you know, it has problems which make it unsuitable beyond a certain point. Nevertheless, it has something to do to prepare the nature.
I have a question. That is, in case of, I mean, materialistic people, like materialistic, not really materialistic people, people who believe in materialism, for them it is almost like, you know, closing one, I mean, when they find the spiritual truth, I mean, truth in the sense that there is a truth of that kind, then it's more like a closing one chapter and then moving forward with another chapter of life, at least in the outer reality. Now, for religion, I mean, people who are pretty much into religion, for them, how does it happen? Is it like not really closing one chapter and then opening a new chapter, or is it like more like a subtler transformation?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. In general, as the way Sri Aurobindo is bringing it out over here, it could be a subtler transformation. That is that if the outer structures of religion, the forms and codes of religion, prepare the nature and allow it to come into contact with the spirit, then it's possible that those structures themselves will cease to have any meaning on the outer sort of level, and there'll be a direct contact with spirit. So it'll be a more subtle transformation that is possible. Generally, I think that's what he's affirming over here.
Then it could be more complex, right? Because at every, since it is subtler, at every point, it's not like a logical step. It's more, I mean, basically any kind of subtler movement, you have to put much more attention so that, because the barrier is thinner, right?
But it could also come as a kind of a automatic growth of consciousness from within that organically transcends the earlier movements. The complexity in it, I agree, in another way also, that is, since it has not thought itself through, it is likely not to really understand what the opposite is. So though it may transform its own nature, it may not be of help to others. It may even be of hindrance to others. That complexity may enter into it.
Hey, it's your chance to be.
I mean, like, if we think of people who are into humanism, like humanity, and people who are into, you know, moral, I mean, you know, justice, these kinds, I mean, there are other kinds of, I mean, for them, for some people, justice is the most divine thing, or most, the best thing that is possible for them. For some people, nature's order, like scientists and all, that is the best thing. For some people, humanism, like love human beings and do as best as you can for human beings, that is the best thing. For them, it's more, I think, it's more like they all of a sudden see that they're not being able to succeed, and the failure sort of directs them that there must be a higher, I mean, I'm just saying, like, general, I'm guessing, general cases, that by hitting with the failures, then so they sort of all of a sudden, or they slowly, whatever way, wake up to the fact that, I mean, there is a need for a higher truth or a power to break it through. So, but in case of religion, since it is already believing that it is having a connection to the highest truth, so it is quite different from that point of view. That's what I was trying to sort of dig into.
That is true. That is what we call idealism of some mental kind, but that is approaching in a more, in some cases, of course, it may be approaching in a subjective fashion, but in many cases, it is approaching socially. That is, it is looking for a solution to the problems of mankind, let's say. So its approach may not be individual in that sense, but it may be approaching in a larger fashion and finding a different kind of answer to the same question, because the original answer did not satisfy it. But in the case of those who turn through religion, it's usually at the individual level that there is some kind of need for connection, either due to, you see, with religion, it's of the problems of human nature itself and one's fate or destiny. That is often the immediate connection with some higher power. That notion of one's fate or destiny, etc., which are more external, may fall off, and instead one may have some contact with something in and by in and for itself. See, that may be the progress in this way, but the social factor may not enter into it, except maybe at a very late stage.
I mean, that individual concentration in religion, in case of religion, it has also that I found God. I mean, this is my God, and others are excluded, in other words. That kind of exclusive individual transcendence is what I was probably talking about.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I meant by lacking the social aspect. I agree. So that can be problematic. That can have its own problems associated with it. That's partly the reason why, you know, in the Vedanta, you know, you can approach from a variety of angles, approach Brahman from a variety of angles, but you have to include the others. You know, as they say, you can approach as Aham Brahmasmi, but realization of Aham Brahmasmi must be extended into Tattvamasi. So that may come at a later stage. But yeah, it may cause problems in between because there isn't that wideness to extend it to universality. In fact, that is one of the sources of, you know, some of the crudenesses that he's talking about here. That, in fact, becomes one of the sources, because that's one of the reasons why religion tends towards fanaticism, towards exclusivism, towards claiming that one's own God is, you know, exclusively the reality without being able to follow after a kind of a wider understanding.
I mean, not only that transcendence that we are referring to could be an illusion. I mean, this is not real. Transcendence is there what they believe.
Yeah, it could be.
Keka, do you want to read the next paragraph?
Sure, thank you. The wide and supple method, right?
Yes.
The wide and supple method of evolutionary nature, providing the amplest scope and preserving the true intention of the religious seeking of the human being, can be recognized in the development of religion in India, where any number of religious formulations, cults, and disciplines have been allowed, even encouraged, to subsist side by side, and each man was free to accept and follow that which was congenial to his thought, feeling, temperament, build of the nature. It is right and reasonable that there should be this plasticity proper to experimental evolution. For religion's real business is to prepare man's mind, life, and bodily existence for the spiritual consciousness to take it up. It has to lead him to that point where the inner spiritual light begins fully to emerge. It is at this point that religion must learn to subordinate itself, not to insist on its outer characters, but give full scope to the inner spirit itself to develop its own truth and reality. In the meanwhile, it has to take up as much of man's mentality, vitality, physicality as it can and give all his activities a turn towards the spiritual direction, the revelation of a spiritual meaning in them, the imprint of a spiritual refinement, the beginning of a spiritual character. It is in this attempt that the errors of religion come in, for they are caused by the very nature of the matter with which it is dealing. That inferior stuff invades the very forms that are meant to serve as intermediaries between the spiritual and the mental, vital or physical consciousness, and often it diminishes, degrades and corrupts them. But it is in this attempt that lies religion's greatest utility as an intercessor between spirit and nature. Truth and error live always together in the human evolution, and the truth is not to be rejected because of its accompanying errors, though these have to be eliminated. Often a difficult business, and if crudely done, resulting in surgical harm inflicted on the body of religion. For what we see as error is very frequently the symbol or a disguise or a corruption or malformation of a truth which is lost in the brutal radicality of the operation. The truth is cut out along with the error. Nature herself very commonly permits the good corn and the tares and weeds to grow together for a long time, because only so is her own growth, her free evolution, possible.
So, you see, here is that description of religion in India as having the more flexible form that we were discussing some time back, that there are a number of religious formulations, cults and disciplines that have coexisted, encouraged to subsist side by side with the freedom given to people to accept and the kind of experimental culture of spirituality. Mm-hmm. This kind of approach has continued even today in the less educated parts of Indian society. See, for example, in village India, or in the kind of various sects and cults that of Indian spirituality that are illiterate in a sense, there is much greater that have not been organized into these more distinct schools. There is much greater freedom and experimental interchange that goes on. But he's also pointing out that this kind of plasticity is necessary for the preparation of the spirit. This is one major point that he's making, that is at the social level. The other point he's making over here, again, has to do with the formulation of religion itself, that needs to have within it the other elements, as we had discussed, like charya, Kriya, Jnana and Yoga, they have to all be intrinsic to the form of religion itself, so that there has to be an encouragement, as it were, to evolve out of the forms into the experience. Experiences must precede or predominate over, and there has to be a way by which purification can take place and a discrimination between the outer and the inner. That's the point he's making, second point he's making. And then he's making this important evolutionary kind of point, which he has made before, as we had discussed, about moving from the near to the far. That is, the crudities and errors are likely to persist, but for a long time, such is allowed by nature, because that's the only way that evolution can happen.
In fact, it sort of answered, I think this is exactly what I was asking. So it's very beautifully portrayed that growing different cones together.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, exactly. This aspect of experimental evolution also is very interesting. You know, if you go to village Bengal, particularly in the Birbhum area, there are a variety of different mystic sects. Some of them are Islamic, for example, they are called the Peers. So, Peers, Baus, Tantrics, they all coexist. And they have their melas, you know, the Baul Mela and Sufi Mela and all that, which are attended by all of these various different sects. And in these, they have discussions, and they also sing songs, etc., in which they state their philosophy in mystic terms, and often use the same terms so that there is a translatability, so that, you know, I mean, they are sharing a common vocabulary so that people can understand what the distinctions are between their approaches. At the same time, they are distinct, but also they share a lot from each other. This is the kind of, you know, experimental spiritual culture that is still prevalent in certain parts of India.
Dhanashish?
Yeah, Rich. Yes.
So if that's sort of an evolutionary, sort of experimental, sort of cultural development, and he's speaking here of development of religions in India, and he's talking about just sort of achieving this sort of coexistence or larger spiritual dialogue.
Yeah.
But in contrasting to that, what would you call the sort of movement of whereby the cluster of these traditions sort of become defined according to this linguistic category Hinduism that's sort of, you know, been defined by sort of a European sense of classification and its role among other religions, and then the development of it into sort of this form of Hindu nationalism, which contradicts actually this sort of development of religion Sri Aurobindo is talking about that India had achieved. So it seems that this, you know, maybe sort of a deficient movement, you know, against this. What had been developing in India over the centuries, but when we talk about sort of this modern form of, you know, Hindu nationalism, which is sort of a very exclusivist sense of itself and the otherness of what it considers non-Indian, Islamic, Mughal, you know, British, whatever. So it seems like there's sort of, you know, several movements going on here.
Yeah, I agree. So that's in fact, you know, exactly as he's pointing out, this is the way in which it had developed and had retained that kind of a form, but along with it, there was a gradual crystallization of a more formal, so to say, Hinduism, which gradually becomes, you know, as you well put it, linguistified, you know, it becomes a linguistic category. And then with nationalism starts developing definable characteristics of identity politics. It's interesting because you see this, you know, several scholars today, Ashish Nandi being one of them, has pointed to this. In fact, I'd go even before that, what Sri Aurobindo is saying, even Rabindranath points to the very same thing about these various, the coexistence of all these various religious groups in subcultural India. And then, you know, in modern times, in contemporary times, you have scholars like Ashish Nandi and Partha Chatterjee. In fact, this whole dimension of the Sufis and Peas and Bowls, etc., has been studied by Partha Chatterjee. What happens is that, you know, some people have thereby started clubbing this entire, you know, revisionary movement, you may say, as illegitimate. That is something that, say, someone like Ashish Nandi does. He says that on the one hand, you have this kind of subaltern culture of village India, and on the other hand, you have the culture that has been educated by contact with the West, and all its, you know, sort of revisions of, evolving native practices are illegitimate. I don't think one can put it like that, but I think that's also an oversimplification. But certainly, there are these two poles that have developed. On the one hand, you have this that was the older Indian development. And on the other, you have this much more fossilized sense of Hindu nation.
There's a parallel with sort of Islamic nationalism as well.
Yes.
And in the sense we've discussed this about this sort of, you know, this period sort of where Indian nationalism sort of comes out of 1857, you know, sort of, you know, I mean, just generally as, you know, when a nationalism of such is articulated, and, you know, again, at the same time, you know, Islam starts to see their evolution as being sort of co-determined by this actually Western sort of European concept of nationalism. And, marriage of the two, it's almost like sort of there's a, you know, it gives one a sense of the complexity of all these different evolutionary movements going on. On one hand, there's sort of this sort of, you know, seems to be a constriction of, you know, what had sort of been, you know, previously maybe, as you say, and still sort of, you know, in sort of folk culture, you know, stepping away from that. Sort of, you know, even sort of, you know, more generally, when one sort of looks at sort of defining Hinduism, it has become sort of this linguistic sort of concept and a simulacra now of the media that sort of defined, you know. And so, you know, our sense actually of these sort of traditions living together, I would say, is sort of, you know, is made obscure by this, you know, larger identity of things into these Hindu nationalist or Islamic nationalist, this sense of, you know, how we sort of even come to know the phenomena of religion and sort of the coexistence of religions today.
Yeah, true, exactly.
Shall we end today here?
Yeah, let's.